Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning call and talk program. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. What do you know about politics and how do you know it? If, like most Americans, you get most of your news from television, are you likely to learn much about candidates' stands on important issues? How do political ads affect voter knowledge? What about news media coverage? These are a few of the questions we'll take up during this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Kathleen Hall Jamison, a noted expert on presidential politics, dean of the Annenberg School for Communication and director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center. She's also the author or co-author of 9 widely read books on American politics, and you've probably known her as a commentator on NPR's Weekend Edition and the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. During this hour, we'll be talking with Kathleen Hall Jamison about her latest book entitled Everything You Think You Know About Politics and Why You're Wrong, recently published in paperback by Basic Books. In the book, Professor Jamison describes some of the results from a decade-long Annenberg study on the effects of campaign communication. The study provides some interesting insights into the effectiveness of political campaigns, the effect of advertising, and the role of the news media and the types of communication that contribute to an informed electorate. We'll talk about all these things as much as we have time for during this hour. As we do so, we invite you into the conversation. If you have questions or comments on the topic, those are welcome. The number to call around Champaign-Urbana, 217-333-9455. I almost gave out the main office number, 333-9455, or WILL. That makes it easier to dial. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest, 800-222-9455. The numbers are very similar, but not quite the same. Around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. All these numbers. Professor Jamison, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Just to start with, can you tell us about this massive study that informs the book?
We began about 10 years ago trying to address the question, have campaigns changed across time? Our concern was that there was a standard description of democracy that was beginning to emerge that seemed very condemnatory and suggested that perhaps there was, in the recent past, a much healthier, more vibrant democracy. And so we started by collecting all the ads, debates, and speeches that we could find from the general election presidential campaigns from 1952 through 1996, and also collected a good amount of the news coverage during that period. And the goal was to try to ask whether, in fact, things had gotten worse, stayed the same, or gotten better. And some of the answers that we found were somewhat surprising, which was the reason we began to work on this book. The second part of this database consists of a lot of surveys that we've done over the last 10 years that were specifically designed to try to find out how people learn about politics, what kinds of information are helpful and translate into informed voting decisions, and what kinds of information seem to confuse. And so there are 6 major surveys that are reported in the book in some form, the most interesting of which to me is a survey in which we actually read people copy from ads to find out what voters think is negative as opposed to what academics and pundits think.
Right. Well, in the big picture, how would you describe the state of voter knowledge? Are we as ill-informed and uninterested as some media commentators seem to think?
No, we're not. The first thing that I think it's important to note is that on Election Day, what you would like to see is the citizen acting as a voter. So you'd like to see voting rather than non-voting. Mm-hmm. But going into the voting booth, feeling informed to cast a vote. So feeling as if there's not really additional information that the person needs. And then you'd like the information that the person has that that person considers relevant to the voting decision to be accurate. And one of the things that we found in our surveys of what the electorate knows is that the electorate is very smart about the way in which it uses information. Unlike political junkies, and I assume that many of your listeners are political junkies, as am I.
I would expect.
Who spend a lot of time reading and watching and listening. Most people don't have that kind of time, but do recognize that some issues matter to them more than others, and manage across a campaign to pick up accurate information on the candidate's similarities and differences on those issues. They tend to become more confused when the positions the parties would be expected to take are not the positions of the candidates, however. And so what we saw was that by the general election of 96, most people on most of the major issues could distinguish Dole from Clinton with reasonable clarity. But they got confused about such things as which candidate supported the balanced budget amendment. Now, in fact, it doesn't matter that you know that if what you're concerned about is do they both support a balanced budget and you don't care about the mechanism. So even those who got confused about which one supported the amendment were probably reflecting the fact that they knew that both supported a balanced budget. But because traditionally the Democrat wouldn't be expected to support a balanced budget or a balanced budget amendment, that knowledge of Clinton was lower than you would have expected. The same thing happens when, for example, Bush of Texas begins to argue that he's the education candidate. You don't ordinarily expect that a Republican is going to take that kind of a position. And so very early in the primaries, people seemed confused by it. Now they've gotten straight the fact that, in fact, this is a different kind of Republican who's going to initiate some educational reforms. And so where the party, the past party positions predict where the candidate would ordinarily stand, voters are right most of the time, and they're right early in the process. But where candidates are moving away from traditional party postures, as Gore is on the death penalty, for example, by supporting it where you'd expect a Democrat to oppose it, they're more likely to be confused longer.
Let's talk about the importance of political campaigns. Every 4 years or every 2 years in the case of congressional elections, it seems that we go through this ritual of groaning about the campaigns. Here we go again. You know, the campaign seems to start earlier every time around. And there's a lot of sort of posturing in the media, I include us in that category, about how painful the whole experience is, and perhaps a cynical idea that, you know, these campaigns, we all know that, you know, they're not really all the time and attention isn't really justified. You argue that's not the case.
One of the things that I think was surprising to us as we looked across the record of candidates who became president was the extent to which what candidates promise in campaigns forecasts what it is they're going to do once they become president. Now, they don't always accomplish what they've promised to try to do, in large part because they have a Congress to deal with. Presidents don't unilaterally get to do much of anything. But to the extent that we looked at the promises made by presidential candidates, and political scientists have done this across a number of decades, what we see is that you can pretty much trust the candidate's rhetoric in campaigns to at least yield an effort to try to perform in that area. And the reason is pretty straightforward. If a candidate makes a major promise and doesn't deliver, the next time around, that candidate's going to be held accountable when he runs for re-election or when his heir apparent runs for re-election. And so the reason that campaigns matter first is that when candidates tell you they're going to try to do something, the odds are they're going to try to do it. And if you think it's a good thing, you may want to support it. If you think it's a bad thing, you may want to find out if the other candidate differs. And most importantly, when both of the candidates tell you they agree about something, the press basically says, that's irrelevant. We're not interested in that. There's no conflict. That's the most important information if you care about consequences in your life. Because if both candidates agree, the likelihood that whatever they agree upon is going to be enacted and as a result affect you within the next Congress is very, very high. And my favorite illustration of that occurred in 1996. I was doing live commentary for CBS News after the debates and was asked by Dan Rather what I thought was the important thing that people could have learned from the debates. And that was the debate in which Clinton agreed with Dole that we should exempt the first $500,000 of capital gains on a primary residence that had been held for at least 3 years. Now, what that meant is that if you were thinking of selling your house, you should delay a year. Because with both the Republican and Democratic nominee agreeing to do that, the chances that it was going to happen the next year were very, very high. So I took my few seconds of fame on CBS and essentially said, that's really consequential for people who are thinking about selling a house. And long term, it's an important change in the way we treat capital gains in housing. And so I thought that that was an important similarity rather than a difference. Now, you can't really vote on a similarity because if they're both similar, how do you distinguish? But it was important to know that as a citizen because, indeed, the next year, Congress made that change.
Another point of cynicism in commenting upon campaigns is the notion that real issues are not really discussed. The candidates basically speak in sound bites and that they, you know, mouth things that were sort of crafted by focus group studies and political consultants. And again, you take issue with this notion and say that real issues are, in fact, discussed during campaigns.
There's an ideal to which we should aspire, and we're not there yet. But we are not at a low point in the history of democracy. There are campaigns that are not particularly helpful campaigns. The 1988 campaign was one of them. There were important issues in the world in 1988. The savings and loan crisis was upon us. The Soviet Union was falling apart as we watched. And we didn't talk about those things. Instead, we talked about furlough programs in Boston Harbor and Pledge of Allegiance. Now, one could argue that there's some symbolic element in each of those that has some importance. And I don't mean to dismiss that. But 1988 wasn't a campaign that forecast governance that made it easier for President George Bush to lead. But 1988 was actually the aberration. In most of the campaigns from 52 through 96, major issues have been addressed. And when the candidates haven't addressed them, we have a good indication that they're not going to be pursued in governance. And so when in 1996, neither Clinton nor Dole would tell us how they were going to fix Medicare, we pretty much knew that for the next 4 years we were going to have a stalemate on Medicare. The fact that this year the candidates are addressing Social Security reform, are talking about where they're going to get the money long term, is a first step toward a discussion that's long overdue. But it's a step that we're taking, and we ought to applaud that.
One of the interesting things I found in your book has to do with what people get out of various forms of communication, political advertising in particular, and news media coverage, and campaign speeches. And you analyzed the content of these things and found some very surprising things, at least to me.
Yeah, the first thing that surprised us, and the book could really be called Everything I Thought I Knew About Politics and Why I Was Wrong, because many of the things that I wrote in earlier books assumed the conventional wisdom, and the book is looking at the conventional wisdom critically. But one of the things that one assumes if one watches a lot of news and reads a lot of news is that candidates spend most of their time in their speeches attacking other candidates, that in debates attack is dominant, and that most of the ads attack most of the time. Well, we found that's just not true. In fact, attack is a fairly unusual part of most speeches and debates. It is a larger part of ads, but it rarely is the dominant form of communication in ads. So why do we think that? Well, reporters feature conflict. And so reporters will take the 5 to 10% of a speech that attacks and assume that it is newsworthy. The problem with that is that by featuring that and not featuring what the candidate is advocating, voters lose track of the connection between the speeches and the debates and the ads and governance, because it's what they advocate that's going to take them into governance, much more so than what it is that they're attacking. And so our first surprise in looking at what you see across speeches, ads, debates, and news was the extent to which news overrepresents the percent of attack in political campaigns, underrepresents the extent of agreement, and underrepresents the extent of advocacy. The second tendency that we saw in news was to take what in a speech or a debate was an argument, a statement with proof, a reason to support a claim, and to simply reduce it to the statement. And so in news, what was argument in a speech becomes assertion. And it gives you a sense that the campaigning is more trivial than it is, that it is not about giving reasons, but it is about just simply staking positions. We also saw that there was a tendency in news, and it is less pronounced this year so far than in some previous years, to take attacks that occur across a speech and to string them together in broadcast news without the evidence for them to suggest that a candidate was a serial attacker. It's very rare for a candidate to give a speech that is primarily attack or to engage in rapid-fire staccato attack with no justification and no indication of what he or she would do differently. Candidates tend to contrast a lot more in their speeches and in debates than news lets them do when it reports. But the other important finding that we thought we saw was one that told us that the system was a lot healthier than some people thought. Because in 1988, a year that I think marked the low point of the modern presidential campaigning, what we saw was a lot of advertising that simply made a case against anonymous voiceover announcer, very vivid, evocative images, a lot of misleading claims, and no case for the candidate in the same ad. And so you don't know, for example, what George Bush would have done about Boston Harbor or about the furlough program. And on the other side, in a Dukakis ad, you don't know that Dukakis actually supported the same position that he attacked Bush for on Social Security. The public didn't like that. It didn't like a kind of advertising that simply snuck up on you in the middle of the night and threw negative information at an electorate. And what the consultants came to realize and what we found out after watching what they had done was that the public prefers a form of advertising that makes a case for you as the advertiser and against the opponent on the same topic, but does so in a way that doesn't exaggerate, isn't personal, is accurate, and gives you a reason to vote for, not against. We see a lot more of that kind of advertising now. In fact, it was the dominant mode in 2000. We call it contrast. It's a healthier form. The public likes it. And candidates are well served by it because they're able to attack, that is, differentiate within it, but they're able to do it without eliciting a backlash.
Let me just take a moment to reintroduce our guest this morning during this hour, Focus 580. We're talking with Kathleen Hall Jamison. She's dean of the Annenberg School for Communication, author of many books, including the one we're discussing, entitled Everything You Think You Know About Politics and Why You're Wrong, recently published in a paperback by Basic Books. Some of her other books, Beyond the Double Bind, Women in Leadership, Dirty Politics, Deception, Distraction, and Democracy, and Packaging the Presidency. And we've talked with her before on this program, and glad to have her back. If you'd like to join our conversation, questions and comments on the topic are welcome. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. I want to ask if you have any idea where we get this cynicism that the campaigns are bogus, that there's no reason to pay attention. Where does this sort of thread of popular thought about politics get such weight?
I think that when things don't go well in even a small area, we tend to feature them. And I think we do that in our lives, in our professions, and I think we do it in politics. And it's healthy to do that to the extent that when you focus on something, you're more likely to try to correct it. But if you focus on it and ignore what else is going on, ignore changes that are happening that are adapting to try to provide a solution to the problem that's been isolated, you can get into a pattern of rhetoric which becomes an unthinking conventional wisdom. And I think there's a lot of unthinking conventional wisdom out there right now, which says that campaigns don't matter, that politicians don't keep their promises, that all they do is attack, that the attacks are all distortive, that as a result you can't trust what you hear in campaigns and there's no reason to be involved. Indeed, if all those things are true, why should you vote? Oh, let's be alarmed. Nobody's voting. And they're not watching debates, but then why should they? Debates are boring and no one learns. And they're not watching conventions. That's too bad. Conventions are boring too, however. So we create a system in which there's a kind of coherent rhetoric that feeds a despair about the process. And it's part of it is looking at the glass as being half empty instead of half full. We see, for example, when we look at the way in which commentators on television and in print talk about debates, a lot of talk among the elites, the people who pay a lot of attention to politics, saying that really there's not going to be much to be learned from the debates. And then after the debate, well, there wasn't very much new here.
Right.
What the elites forget is that those of us who follow politics for a living, of course, know what the candidates are saying in debates. We've read the position papers, the speeches, but the rest of the public doesn't have time to do that. And what we know from our research about debates, and this is a widely confirmed finding, other researchers have found the same thing, is that regardless of how educated you are, you're likely to learn from debates. The lower educated individuals, because they haven't paid much attention to news, have a lot to learn and learn it from debates. Those who know a lot still learn from debates because the focus on conflict in news means that they've missed some of what the candidates have been advocating. And so if we start out by saying, well, nobody's watching debates, we should be alarmed, but at the same time we've said there's nothing new, we've implied you shouldn't watch. But you should watch because we know there's a lot to learn, and in fact the public finds debates to be a very important experience if you can draw them to it. But the commentary structure drives people away. The other place that we see this is reporters who over-represent the attack in politics and then decry the negativity of campaigns. And there's a human disposition, I think, to feature the negative. I certainly did that in the book Packaging the Presidency, and I wasn't even aware I was doing it. I thought I was writing about all the ads in the history of the modern presidency in that book. And in fact, if you go through and you check them off, I didn't miss many ads, but I spent a lot more time on those attack ads. Well, the reason probably is that our ancestors going way, 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 way back, who weren't somewhat wary about signs of danger, read that as potential attack, were eaten by predators before they passed on their genes. And those who were very wary were not eaten by predators. They probably passed on their wariness. So we're probably hardwired in some way to feature attack. We probably are all doing it. I certainly did it as a scholar. And we probably need to back off of that consciously in order to give the American public a more realistic sense of how politics actually functions.
Very interesting. We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's go ahead and include them. We'll go first to a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, good morning, Jack. I was calling. I haven't been listening very closely, but I was calling with the concern about the emphasis on just two candidates when we actually have maybe four candidates or more. And I was wondering if that might be a disservice, both coming from the interviewers or the reporters or the guests on programs, whether it's locally or nationally, that emphasize two candidates rather than the whole field. And I'll just hang up and listen to your response.
Thanks for the question. Yeah.
I share your concern. The first problem for the reporter is that there actually are over 100 candidates right now who are certified and running. Now, most of them don't have ballot access. Reasonably, one could say that Buchanan and Nader have enough ballot access to be taken seriously, however. But the difficulty for reporters is, in a finite amount of space, how do you get the information forward? And they make the inference that the candidates who are most likely to win are the ones who deserve the most attention. The problem, of course, is that means that the candidates who are qualifying for ballot access, that means that they, in theory, could win, aren't getting the news exposure that could help them raise the visibility, in the case of Nader, to be able to get into the debates, actually in the case of Buchanan as well. And we've set up a structure in the United States that is a two-party structure that reinforces the parties in the way in which we give out federal funds and the way in which we permit people into debates. And it's unfortunate because if you look historically at the way in which the best ideas of the democracy have percolated forward, they have come not simply from the mainstream parties. They've come from third parties, which occasionally have become major parties. In 1992, Ross Perot gets into the debates because neither candidate is comfortable trying to keep him out, and as a result puts the deficit at the center of the agenda in the debates, where it wouldn't have been there at all had it been up to Bush and up to Clinton. The fact that it was there makes it easier for the Democrats and the Republicans to address that issue. And Ross Perot, as a result, I think deserves some credit for the deficit reduction efforts that have taken place since then. Now, he wasn't going to win in 1992, but he did add something to the dialogue. The other problem that we see with the candidates who are qualified for ballot access but get less press coverage is that the nature of the polls in relationship to journalism is such that if you're low in the polls, journalists tend to give you less access, and less access means you're going to be lower in the polls. We did as part of the study for the book Everything You Think You Know About Politics and Why You're Wrong, we looked at the way in which the polls affected the news access of five candidates for mayor in Philadelphia. And what we could show was that the amount of time that they got in news, that is, the amount of time that they were quoted speaking or their views were paraphrased, was directly proportional to their positioning in the polls. The candidate with the least amount of news time was the candidate whom the reporters thought was the person who was behind in the polls. Now, why is that a problem? It's a problem because the polls were bad. The last three candidates of those five were actually within the margin of error of each other, and so that last candidate was being seriously discriminated against for no good reason at all. And even if that poll was accurate, is it fair to lock him into the status of the last candidate by virtue of the fact that he's getting the least coverage? Maybe he had the best ideas, or maybe he had ideas that, if they had been brought into the discussion with the candidates who are supposedly ahead, might have yielded a different kind of dialogue. And so I'm very concerned about the issue that you raise, and particularly concerned about the structural constraints that we've created in the ways in which we make money available to candidates and the ways in which we make access to debates available, what that does long-term to our ability to have a coherent democratic dialogue that, as efficiently as possible, brings new ideas into the mainstream.
With our midpoint during this hour of Focus 580 with Kathleen Hall Jamieson talking about her book, Everything You Think You Know About Politics and Why You're Wrong, we have one caller waiting and we'll welcome others. 333-WILL around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with our next listener in Dunlap on line number four. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. I've enjoyed your program. I've noticed that most of the conversation so far has focused on campaigns in the past. And I'm wondering if you could delineate for me and other listeners any specific policy differences between this year's two major presidential candidates. What are they advocating? What are they disparaging, et cetera? Okay.
The way to structure one's sense of the candidate's similarities and differences is to pay attention to the conventions. And if you listen to the Bush acceptance speech, what you see is a focus on four issues. He believes that the military doesn't have the state of readiness that is required, and argued in the speech incorrectly that two divisions weren't ready to report for duty at the moment. It turns out that they weren't ready because they were in Bosnia about a year ago, but that doesn't mean they weren't ready to report. They were already on duty. But technically, they wouldn't have been able to be called forward at that point, but right now all 10 divisions are ready. But he believes that we don't have the military pay that the military deserves and the military readiness that is required. Gore, on the other hand, argues that the cutbacks in the military occurred under Bush Cheney, that is George W. Bush's father, and Dick Cheney as Secretary of Defense, and that the Clinton administration has, in essence, built back up in some of those areas. However, in the process, the Clinton administration also continued to deepen some of those cuts. Now, the underlying issue here is, what kind of a military do we actually need? We're not in a Cold War anymore, so we may not need the level of expenditure and the kind of defense that we had before. And if what we need is the capacity to engage in peacekeeping around the world, then you would need a different kind of military than if you were prepared to fight a two-front war, for example, against major alternative powers. There also is a distinction between the candidates about how rapidly they would build a missile defense system. Bush would build it more rapidly, it would be larger scale, and he's ready to move away from the ABM treaty in order to do it. Gore wants to work within the additional treaties and modify them, and at this point supports a smaller missile defense system that would not be deployed as extensively. And so there's a difference there that will have consequences in terms of how we defend long term. If we are going to have a missile defense system at all, the underlying questions there are, do we have the capacity to build it in a way that it will work? The tests so far of it have not raised one's confidence that at this point we have the technical expertise to do it. And secondly, an issue that has not been widely discussed, but is in fact causing great concern in the international community, which is, if we're going to deploy a missile defense system, does that make a lot of people around the world who view us potentially as an aggressor very apprehensive and cause an arms buildup? Specifically, does it cause problems with such places as the states that were the former Soviet Union? And so there's a very serious issue in which there's a general agreement that there's going to be a missile defense system. There's a disagreement about scale, scope, and how we're going to deal with treaties. The second area that George W. Bush treated in his, and I'm using him as the framework because he started first, because he had the first convention, the second area in which he articulates strong commitment to set an agenda is education. The Bush agenda essentially stresses reading and reading readiness. And Bush has worked with the school system in ways that are atypical of a Republican, or particularly a Republican running for president, to try to improve Texas schools. He's carrying on the legacy of his Democratic predecessors in doing it, but he deserves credit for a strong investment in public education. And his emphasis is going to be on Head Start transformed into a reading program, increased local control, and increased accountability at the local level. On the Gore side, the one piece of the Bush agenda that causes the most concern is that Bush also supports vouchers. He would let you take, when a school is faltering, money from the public school and move it into the school of the choice of the parent whose child is being failed by the public school. Gore strongly opposes vouchers. He supports higher levels of money to go into buildings, the school structures themselves. Clinton proposed more money for school infrastructures early in his presidency, didn't get it through Congress, and they've come back in the past to try to get it in place. But the reality is, many people perceive that there's a problem with school buildings needing to be rebuilt, and so there's more money there from Gore. In general, about 7% of the money in education is federal. There isn't a big federal role. Yep. For Gore, there would be more money. There would be more government-level involvement. For Governor Bush, there would be less money, more money switched from one place to another in the form of vouchers, but more of a focus on reading. And that of itself is interesting. The third issue that Governor Bush forecast was strengthening Social Security. The difference there is that Bush would permit you to take some of your payroll tax. He hasn't specified how much. Some people speculate that it'll be 1/6, and invest it in the stock market, manage your own money. Gore would let you take money over and above the payroll tax and set it aside with some tax advantage and some government matching under some circumstance. The question for Bush is, in that transition, because the money right now that's paid in the payroll tax goes right to the elderly under our current system, it's a direct transfer, how are we going to make up the money that is now going to be moved into investments, hence not in that channel that will move, that will be moving forward to make sure that those with Social Security are currently protected? Long term, they both, however, have got to address the issue of solvency, and neither of them has done that in a way that will ensure the long-term survivability of Social Security, although each has a plan that would short-term provide some additional solvency. In this general area, there's also a debate about prescription drugs.
Right.
In the prescription drug area, the Bush proposal is not really fleshed out yesterday. It's not fleshed out yet. Yesterday, he said he would support Brofist, which is the Republican proposal in Congress. Essentially, if he does, the first question is, you know, where is the money going to come from? He says from Medicare savings. Gore has money mapped out in his budget for a prescription drug benefit. The Bush benefit, and you hear this in the ads, would provide access but not a guarantee of a benefit.
Right.
And it would provide it through HMOs and through insurance, that is through private sector, which is traditionally the way a Republican will move. A Republican trusts the market more than the Democrat does. Where Gore would provide something that would look much more like the standard Medicare benefit, and it would have more of a universal entitlement attached to it. In both cases, low-income seniors would be likely to have more access to affordable drugs, prescription drugs, than they would now have. The difference appears to be, and we won't know for sure until we see the actual boundaries of the Bush plan, that more people at other income levels would get some relief under the Gore plan than under the Bush plan, but we need to wait and see for details. The final area that Bush forecasts the difference and Gore is engaged on is tax cuts. Of the projected surplus, and it's important to remember it's a projected surplus,
right,
Bush would spend a lot more of it on a tax cut that is a tax cut that benefits people at all income levels, because the tax cut is affecting everyone at all income levels. But because people who make a lot of money pay the most taxes, they would get the most back under this plan. Gore also has a tax cut, but the philosophy is different. It's a targeted set of tax cuts, so you don't automatically get it, and you don't get it if you make over $100,000. He's pretty much phased out the option to exercise the targeted tax cuts between $60,000 and $100,000. But you have to do something. So there's $3,000, for example, of tax credits for long-term care. There's $10,000 for tuition for college students, I believe, applied only to one person in a family at a time. But targeted. It's targeted to social goals. The difference is classic party difference. A Democrat is more comfortable with government specifying the goal and creating incentives to help you get there. The Republicans are more comfortable saying, it's your money, I'm going to give it back, you do what you think is best.
Right.
Those from the perspective of an outline that Bush would lay up are the significant differences. Gore then adds some additional issues. Gore says, I am more pro-choice. That is, I don't favor the restrictions on abortion rights that Bush supports. Bush favors abortion only in the case of rape, incest, abortion rights only in the case of rape, incest, and a threat to the life of the mother. There's a difference on handguns and handgun control, with Gore favoring licensing, Bush not favoring. And that really hasn't been engaged much directly, but it's been engaged in issue advocacy ads. And then there's a difference in providing health care insurance for children. Gore would pledge to cover all children within a set frame of time on an incremental basis to move us ultimately, he says, towards full universal health care coverage.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. I had picked up on each of those issues, but I wondered if you, as the person whose time is really occupied full-time with this, had found something that I might have missed. But I think your summary was excellent. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
I'm sure I missed a lot of things, but that Tracy is based on what it is they're featuring right now across their rhetoric. And one of the things that people don't realize is the extent to which the public did learn from conventions. If your caller could track all of those issues, your caller probably pays pretty close attention to politics, including to the conventions and to the commentary surrounding the conventions. We did a survey, in fact, we're doing an ongoing survey, that found that after the Republican convention, people were more likely to be able to place George Bush accurately on his major proposals. After the Democratic convention, they were also more likely to accurately be able to place Gore. And that was true even of people who didn't pay attention to conventions. The reason it's true is that conventions mark a point at which the public realizes it's supposed to pay more attention to politics. And those who are highly attentive are more likely to talk to other people as a result during that time. There's a lot more news coverage. And as a result, the combination of local and national news and talk with family and friends and those who pay attention to conventions helps push up our learning about the positions on issues of both of the candidates. And that's a sign of an electorate that works, not a dysfunctional electorate.
What's really interesting is in that about 8 or 10 minute summary, which was most excellently performed by you in the issues pertaining to the candidates and their disagreements and so forth. I mean, I recognize all those from media coverage, and yet we still hear this idea that there are no issues being discussed.
Yeah, the part of the problem is that, I mean, notice how long it took me to do that. And nobody is going to give anybody 10 minutes of time outside of public radio or the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer
right.
in order to lay those things out. One of the reasons that public broadcasting is so important to our political system is that it takes the time to elaborate issue differences and similarities, and also to, in the process, establish something that I think is really important to politics, which is that people of goodwill and integrity can disagree about things because philosophically they have different premises. And depending on which premise you grant, you may want to accept one point of view or the other. But politics is not about my pointing my finger at you and calling you ignorant and stupid and saying that you're evil. It is about my saying your philosophy is wrong in my judgment and you saying your philosophy is wrong in my judgment. Now let's talk about what our philosophies would dictate and let's see where the differences and similarities fall out so that the public can decide philosophically where it wants to be. And because you've got the 15-minute segments on Lehrer, because you've got the extended pieces on issues on National Public Radio, we consistently find that people who watch the Sunday morning shows, who watch Nightline, who watch Lehrer, who listen to NPR, are the most likely to be able to provide elaborated understandings, not only of the point of view that they have, but of the other side, and to recognize that there are legitimate differences here, and not to assume that the other side is somehow menacing and evil.
We have several calls to talk with. Let's go ahead and include as many as we can before we run out of time. We'll go next to a listener in Clifton on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, good morning. And it's my thinking that a little bit of old Harry S. Truman integrity wouldn't hurt this country a bit today. In other words, tell it like it is and be honest. And the apathy that goes on with our people is to be appalled. I've got one thought. I don't hear it brought up very often, but one big mistake I think the American people make is we don't go vote in the primaries. And I'm so sad. I wanted Bill Bradley to be nominated. I wanted John McCain to be nominated. I would love to have Colin Powell as candidate for President of the United States. But the party leaders wanted Bush and Gore, so that's what we got. And I don't have much else. Last week I was at the National Veterans of Foreign Wars Convention in Milwaukee, and I heard George Bush talk, and I heard Madeleine Albright talk. And one thing that comes to me is that I think America forgets our veterans. They forget how important freedom is. And right now I know for a fact that the morale of our troops is not very good, and I don't think the military is in very, very good shape at all. And I'm not wanting to go and spend all our money on military, but I think we do need to be a whole lot better off than we are. And I guess I'll just stop right there and see if you have any comments.
Thanks for the call.
I think the areas in which there are divisions are areas about the underlying philosophy that should govern our deployment of the military. I don't think there's disagreement about the way in which we should treat those who serve. And I think that the country was appalled to learn that we have people in uniform who are on food stamps. Now, those numbers have been declining, but that there is any person who is in uniform in this country who is having to use food stamps to support his or her family is something of which I think we should be profoundly ashamed. The fact that both of the candidates are recognizing that we need to do more to be fair to our men and women in uniform is, I think, reflecting a national consensus. To the extent that the public understands that as an issue, I think the support levels are going to rise. And that's a support for individuals, not for military weapons and not for a certain philosophy of deployment. I think there's another thing that is important as we talk about this. When you talk about military morale being low, that argument is often tied to recruitment being down. And the recruitment is, in fact, somewhat down. Whether morale is down, I don't know, because I'm not familiar with the data in that area. But in an environment in which we have an economy that is doing very well, one of the pools for the military consists in that young person who looks at the economy and says, a good career choice for me would be going into military service. There aren't good other choices in the economy. In a full employment economy, we're always going to have recruitment problems drawing people into the military. But if the market works, what that should mean is that we should increase pay, we should increase benefits, we should make that a more attractive career. And I'm hopeful that we're going to see that as the byproduct of the problems that we've had in recruiting, because what you would like to see is going into the military being seen as the same kind of career option as the others that are out there in a full employment economy, and one that people not only would feel comfortable exercising, but would be proud to exercise and could exercise without jeopardizing the well-being of their families.
Very good. We'll go on. We have a couple callers waiting, and we'll hopefully get them both in before we're out of time. Next up, a listener in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, a comment and a question. Comment is that that race you were talking about with three people where two of them got all the news coverage and the third person was kind of cheated, it kind of points to the, I believe it's a well-founded psychological premise that people think the winner of a debate, for example, is the one who talks the most, which is you know, why the Supreme Court was really wrong to call money free speech, because it just allows one person to go on, and the other person to get flooded, you know, overwhelmed with, and it sounds as if the person who's going on the longest is the one with the better ideas, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, my question was, I read this article recently that said that they analyzed the personalities of all the presidents and of the American Psychological Association, and they said that one of the better predictors of a great president was competence. And they didn't go into much in detail as to what they meant by that. But I was just curious if competence, the ability to project each candidate's competence in this race, is kind of critical to me, because it seems to me that there's been a lot of misleading and a lot of dodging and omission going on in terms of these two. And I'd like you to at least talk a little bit about it, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
We know that when voters assess what political scientists call traits of candidates for office, that the leadership dimension or the competence dimension is a very important dimension. We also know that is not simply a perception about biography and past record, that part of it has to do with the ways in which people present issues, whether they appear to be principled, and that related, you know, combination of things that probably go into all of our judgments of other people. And so, you know, how one assesses competence is, I think, a very important question. I think the study that you're alluding to is part of a book that is just published by Fred Greenstein, and I would encourage you to take a look at it if you're interested in this area, because I know he knows a lot more about it than I do. Let me comment about two of your other points quickly. I think Buckley was wrongly decided. I don't think money should equal speech, because if money equals speech, then the person with the most money has the most speech. I think the problem with Buckley is that the court fundamentally misunderstood the extent to which the airwaves are finite. in an environment in which there are audiences that are desirable audiences. One can say that there's unlimited airspace, and as a result, all voices have a capacity to be heard. But first, it costs money to get on the airwaves, and that's the only way to reach a mass audience. And secondly, when one side has substantially more money than the other, and I show this in the book in a chapter on the debate over the McCain tobacco bill, where the tobacco industry outspent the anti-tobacco side 40-1, the other side's voice doesn't get heard at all. Effectively, it's drowned out. And so what Buckley has done is created a world in which soft money advertising increases the power of those with money over those without money. And whether you would agree with one side or another, I think a basic democratic principle ought to be that we all ought to have the capacity to get our arguments heard in some, at least at some level, so that voices aren't being drowned out. And as importantly, misleading statements aren't trafficked out without the capacity of the other side to rebut. On the other point that you made, one of the things that we know about debates is that after most debates, most people's views of the candidates have simply been reinforced. So if, for example, I go into a debate saying that I think John Smith is the best candidate, it's likely after the debate I'm still going to think that John Smith is the best candidate and I'm going to think he won. On the other hand, if you support the other candidate, you're going to think that that candidate did the better job. There's some exceptions, but in general, that's the way debates function, which is what makes the polls after debates so pernicious. One of the chapters in the book shows that the polls that are the instant polls after debates are taken based on a sampling frame that divides the electorate into the pre-polled preferences of the candidates who are debating. Now, if all debates do is reinforce and you've set up your polling frame so that you're basically looking at a snapshot of where the polls put people, you're going to reinforce that poll perception. You're going to translate it into winning and losing, but it means no such thing. The audience that watches debates is not the same as the national audience that's polled. If you actually polled the audience that watched the debates, which, of course, they can't do that fast, you'd get different results. And interestingly, they would be uninformative, too, because Republicans are more likely to watch debates than Democrats. And as a result, if you did the poll that way, you'd be more likely to find that the Republican always did better.
Very interesting. Well, there's much more to talk about than we've had time for, and I'm sorry to say that we're out of time, so we're going to have to stop, and there are a couple callers I must apologize to that we could not include. As I say, there's much more in the book, including a chapter on a model of rhetoric for democratic deliberation that I think is worth the price of admission alone in your book.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you know, perhaps another day we'll have a chance to talk more about that, but we'll have to leave it there for now.
I would love to do that.
Okay. And the book, again, is entitled Everything You Think You Know About Politics and Why You're Wrong, published by Basic Books. And the author has been our guest, Kathleen Hall Jamieson. And thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome.